Hello, I'm Malik Gaines, an artistic director at The Industry and the composer of Star Choir. With me is my collaborator and co-director, Alexandro Segade, who is also the librettist. Hi, Zandro.
Hi, Malik.
Writing this science fiction chamber opera about a space exodus has been quite a journey for us.
It has. And its premiere at the historic Mount Wilson Observatory is an exciting arrival after years of planning.
I'm very grateful for the many amazing opportunities we've had to develop this piece,
including in an LA workshop with The Industry last year.
And way back in 2020, we had a residency with the 62 Center for Theater and Dance at Williams College. But in that moment, the best development we could do was on Zoom. So we shared the documentation of the work in progress with three impressive experts from different fields whom we invited to respond.
We're fans of these smart people, and we're excited about the very different perspectives they could bring together, just as our piece combined musical influences and adapted from different sources, including genre literature, film, and TV, as well as speculative theory.
So we've assembled here that series of short conversations with Dr. Pamela Gay, astronomy podcaster and specialist and scientist for the Planetary Science Institute, Samuel R. Chip Delaney, acclaimed novelist and memoirist, and Anjali Fatima Raza Kolb, literary theorist and associate professor of English at Dartmouth University.
This conversation was held in 2020, so all of the biographical information and breaking science news is from then.
And the general feeling, too.
But the questions are as relevant now as they ever were.
We want to thank these folks for giving us both supportive and critical notes reflecting their own unique points of view.
We took their feedback to heart as we revised Star Choir into the finished work it is today.
We hope you find this conversation thought-provoking. We sure did.
Our first guest is Dr. Pamela Gay, an astronomer, writer, and podcaster focused on using new media to educate people in science and technology. Her most well-known project is Astronomy Cast, a podcast she co-hosts with Fraser Cain. She holds degrees in astronomy and astrophysics and is a senior education and communication specialist and senior scientist for the Planetary Science Institute.
Dr. Gay, thank you so much for joining us. We listen to your podcast on long drives and airplane flights and
while drawing and a lot.
It's really my honor to be here. It takes the inspiration of artists to bring people to see the beauty of science in so many cases. And it's to the arts that I turn most of my free time. So thank you for creating something of so much importance.
One of the things that you do is like describe science in really relatable and understandable terms. We did our general ed requirements in college, but it never was my strong suit. So I can follow you when you're talking about complicated astrophysics questions and you convey those to a wider audience. Can you just say how you came to know how to do that or what some of your strategies are?
I think a lot of it comes from the realization that we understand things through storytelling. We understand things through analogy. And it's also just fun to anthropomorphize pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And it's because part of me always wanted to be a writer. Part of me always wanted to go down the art part. But that thing you have to transform from going through the actions to creating something beautiful, I don't have that to the same degree that people like you do, but I can reach for it in how I describe science. I can borrow from narrative style and prose and storytelling and get people to look beyond our world by making it clear that stars have lives, galaxies beat each other up, and it's in these stories that we can see them changing and maybe relate it to the change we go through as we grow.
Sometimes I wonder also, do we know, this is a little out there, but do we know that stars don't have a kind of subjective experience? How do we know that what's happening is something else?
There's a line from Our Town that really sticks with me for a lot of things like this. It's, sometimes the drunkards and the poets are the only ones that know the answers to certain questions. And that's a terrible paraphrase. And and I think this falls into the category of things that philosophers can debate and come to different conclusions based on different schools of thought, and we have no way to understand. But life as we know it, which is really the only thing we have the capacity in the language to discuss, life as we know it isn't something that the roiling ball of plasma that is our sun and all the stars out there, they're not capable of having life as we understand it.
So how useful is our idea of intelligent life or sentience for describing the many things that are out there? And yeah, what are the sort of the limits of that model?
It's a starting point. We can start from the idea that life is grounded in our ability to recognize ourselves, recognize our death, the need and drive to procreate and to recoil from pain. Fire shows many of the attributes of life, but it doesn't try and protect itself. It doesn't try and protect its own life. And so we have to look for what are the things that makes life different. And then we have to try and define it in a way that we can recognize it scientifically. And this is where we really struggle, because we see in our own reality the need for DNA. Is that necessary everywhere? No idea. We see in our own reality the need for metabolism at a cellular level. Is that necessary everywhere? We don't know. But it's a starting point. And it's better to have a starting point surrounded by vast swaths of there be dragons than to simply sit on our hands and say, we can't understand this, and not even try to understand it.
Well, with that in mind, because I do think a lot about the sort of the Fermi paradox problem, and I think part of it is this intelligence thing that we're looking for, a reflection of our own way of thinking in a way. When we say intelligence, it's possible, I don't know. But I guess one example that really puts the test to that is the recent discovery of phosphine in Venus's atmosphere. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about the significance of that discovery and what it suggests about potential life forms outside of Earth.
So this is a discovery in process. Science is something that happens one step at a time, and sometimes those steps are backwards or sideways. There has been a paper published that states that using two different telescopes, they have detected the molecule phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus at levels that are consistent but not proof of there being biological processes taking place in the atmosphere of Venus. Now, there's caveats on this study. It was realized that there was a systematic problem in the software that they used with one of those two telescopes' data pipelines, which is a fancy way of saying that the way the astronomers got the data might have had issues in it that makes that phosphine detection go away for one of the two telescopes. This is ongoing. I'm going to continue on pretending everything's just fine with the data. What was predicted as far back as the 1960s, before many of us on this call were born, was that there are layers in Venus's atmosphere that have pressures like what we experience here at the surface of the Earth, have temperatures consistent with life, with water, and that it's possible that lofted up in the atmosphere in sustained droplets of water, not like droplets in our atmosphere that are there for a moment and gone the next, but sustained droplets that can last for long periods of time. It's possible in each of these individual droplets that combine and split that microscopic life could find a way, rising up, intermixing, breeding, following the cycle of the air, falling back down, and just becoming spores in that haze layer lower down in Venus's atmosphere. It's a cycle. And that haze can later be lofted up, collect water around these particles, allowing the life to come back. Now, if this kind of life exists, it could be phosphine, and it could relate to phosphine, and aerobic life is what it's referred to, life that doesn't rely on oxygen. So this is something that was predicted. It's something that is consistent with what we had imagined. It has a possible life cycle that we can describe beautifully. And we absolutely do not have the technology to go and grab a sample of the atmosphere, stick it under a microscope, and look and see what's there. And it's kind of driving all of us crazy. There's been some folks that re-reduced earlier data taken by spacecrafts that went through the atmosphere, and they're now saying they might be seeing evidence of phosphine too. They just don't know. So what this is saying is there is a chemical signature potentially that is consistent with life, but doesn't require it. And for this reason, we need to go and explore more, see more. And this isn't the only place in our solar system consistent with the ability for life to be supported. I'm not talking intelligence.
Right.
But if you can have life arising multiple places, and just once it became sentient and intelligent, and I'll argue the intelligent part, but sentient, right. Well, hopefully it's common throughout the galaxy.
Because we're talking about Mars, we're talking about some moons of the gas giants, there's
Titan, Enceladus, Europa.
So then I want to know, and how do we jump ahead and know, are we all related? Are we all part of some diaspora of life, or is this something that arises independently under these conditions?
And this is where the idea of all of the above is honestly where I put my belief system. And again, this is something we can't prove right now. So we do know that approximately 2 billion, 3 billion years ago, Mars began to become inhospitable to life. Earth and Venus probably still were capable of supporting life. And we know that 3.5 billion years ago, all three worlds were probably capable of supporting life. And at the same time, there were massive asteroids colliding with all the worlds. We have pieces of Mars here on Earth that were sent here by these collisions. We suppose that Mars has chunks of Earth. We don't know about Venus. It's been a bit weathered. We can't figure out what Venus meteorites would look like on Earth. We may have pieces of Venus, who knows? But this idea that because there were so many different collisions going on, there was so much debris getting tossed into space, there is very much the potential for microscopic life to have readily made it from one world to another. So you can have this idea of panspermia. Now, at the same time, we also see comets coming into our solar system from other solar systems. But we also had the same kinds of conditions for forming life, warm clays under ocean vents. We find over and over in astronomy that the universe does the same thing in multiple different ways. And I think that if you can find multiple ways to form high density, highly magnetic magnetar neutron stars, you can probably find multiple ways to form life and combine it in new and interesting ways.
So one last question for this segment. How do ethical questions interface with science when we discuss exploration and colonization of extraterrestrial worlds and their indigenous life? Or if, you know, where do these considerations appear in planning and experiments? I mean, in science fiction, we often have a kind of militaristic mining company that wins always, sort of like Earth. Can science help us out of these sort of dynamics?
So unfortunately, in our modern era, science is largely funded either by massive research and development programs looking for money makers, or in small dollar amounts by a government that is funding basic research in hopes that it will eventually lead to massive money makers. In all likelihood, the next big mission to Mars and the first one to include humanity is going to come from SpaceX, where it is funding from their Starlink program that allows them to bridge to the red planet with human exploration. That is science funded by commercialism. It is funded in a way that on one hand potentially will bring internet to parts of the world that just don't have ready access, changing the economy of our planet and lifting up myriad societies around the world, while also at the same time erasing our ability to do the level of sophisticated ground-based observing we do today. We're ruining our science while improving our society, and that is an ethical quandary that many people struggle with. We are doing this to fund scientific exploration, but what if that turns out to not be lucrative? Does it end? We struggle and struggle and struggle. And at the end of the day, it always comes down to where does the dollar stop and where does it come from? And the fact that we have to have that discussion of money, well, as long as we live in that future instead of a Star Trek future, and here I'm talking Next Generation and the original series, not Discovery or Picard, those got a bit dark. It's as long as we're not in a society where people are free of having to worry about where food comes from, science is going to be limited by consumerism.
On that difficult note of struggle.
Thank you.
But struggle feels real. So thank you, Dr. Gay, and we'll bring you back into the conversation. But thank you so much for those opening thoughts. Thank and let's turn now to our next guest, Samuel Delaney, who needs no introduction, but we'll offer one anyway.
Yes. Writer, literary critic, and professor Samuel Delaney first rose to prominence in the mid-1960s with his experimental and genre-bending science fiction novels and short stories. His books include Dahlgren, Babel 17, Trouble on Triton, Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand, Times Square Red, Times Square Blue. Just a few of his works in fiction and nonfiction that are critically acclaimed for revisiting themes of language, knowledge, societal forms, norms, sexuality. In July of 2002, he was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. So as science fiction readers may be more literate in culture than in science or math, your work has helped us to speculate how we might live outside of the present. When we had an email exchange, you pointed out that We Awoke 2x2 from our libretto, quote, sounds like a really conservative view of human relationships. And then you put a little smiley face, which I appreciated. But and I thought that there was definitely something to that. And we were actually trying to talk about a transformation of humanity that could potentially happen in this new context. I'm wondering, how do you begin depicting or imagining social forms that aren't conservative, normative, or even familiar at all in your work? And here I think about Trouble on Triton. I think about Babel 17, Dahlgren.
Well, my mind runs very similar to Pamela Gay's. I mean, when I think about going to Venus, I think, you know, those clouds are basically large steaming. They're boiling oil. They're humanity. You know, they're hydrocarbons is what those clouds are. There's some water in them, but most of it is hydrocarbons. And the temperature is up there around the boiling point of water, sometimes above, sometimes just below. And you say, what is life dependent on? Basically, it's dependent on protein. And protein doesn't exist. You see what happens when you just, you know, leave it at 300 degrees for 45 minutes. You eat it, and it's come apart into much smaller units. So there are people who have tried to deal with that. I have two writers whom I like very much. One is his work reads like science fiction, and I even edited a book of his work myself called The Magic, and Roger Zelazny, who wrote a story about going to Mars and a story about going to Venus. And he very purposely, he was fairly scientifically literate, and they were about not the science's version of Mars and Venus. They were about the 1920s vision of Mars and Venus. What would have happened if Mars indeed had canals and a breathable atmosphere? What would have happened if you got to Venus and you found it was water? And he wrote two wonderful stories, one called, what are their names? The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth is the one about Venus, and A Rose for Ecclesiastes is the story about Mars. There's another science fiction writer. Here is a book he wrote, who wrote about a scientifically reasonable Venus and Mars, John Varley. And he has a story called In the Bowl, which is a story about what if you did get to Mars and it really did have this kind of temperature, it did have this kind of atmosphere, it really was dark all day on the surface, and you were living in a black desert. And so what you'd have to do to deal with it. And then he also, and other people indeed have written about reasonable trips to Mars. There's a wonderful essay by a friend of mine, Ron Drummond, called The First Woman on Mars, that I like, which is an attempt to think about what would happen if we actually did get to Mars with people. And I commend them both to you for some ideas, which brings me to my main thought about the libretto you send me. Which I read through, and it was certainly interesting. Let me say, by the way, I really like the music. As a musical composition, I think that's lots of fun. But the thing is, first of all, most librettos are not the most important part of opera, other than providing a story. And secondly, what they can do, however, that I think you should think about, is giving us a sense of the place where these things are happening. If we can see where it's all happening, the whole thing becomes a very different thing. And I would like to see, as a lover of experimental opera, I've been writing about opera and what have you. If you read in my essay collections, you know, and there are science fiction operas before Enyara, you know, Carl Berger Blumdahl's, and the guy that won a Nobel Prize winner wrote the libretto to that. And you know, these, and I'm sure you're familiar, you guys are musically literate, so you know all of this stuff. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But I would like to see in the libretto some descriptions that would probably be easier to convey than narrative, which is hard to follow in a thing, but descriptive passages of where you are, where these people have gotten to. I think that would be more, you know, and how it looks different from the landscape they left. And you do that, and you've got something that, you know, that the audience can take home. They described a place I'd never been. If you could spend some time doing that, you might have, you know, as I said, that's one of the ideas that hit me. And don't forget that, you know, don't forget that proteins got to survive, you know, if you're going to have life. And so you probably are not, life is going to be very, very rare in the universe. There are billions of stars, and many of the stars have planets. So there are going to be multi billions of planets. But until we get to them, and we get to them by some reasonable technological way, maybe one out of 200 or 300 of these planets are going to have life. You know, so you got to explore an awful lot of them before you find one of the many millions that may have, you know, advanced civilizations. You know, mm-hmm. we're very lucky that ours does.
Mm-hmm. I really, yeah, and we're
lucky, but I know. I wonder sometimes whether the planet itself is lucky that it has us. It may be getting ready to sort of, you know, just to shrug us off in the next few years.
Yeah,
you know, it's decided that we've messed up in the last 150 years with a much too quickly exploding technology and a mental situation that doesn't as a group we don't think about consequences in long-term ways. And so maybe it's just, you know, the planet itself is getting ready to, you know, to bring us off by a very small rise in temperature.
That'll do it. Yeah, they're going to leave us on red.
Melt all the ice caps, the water ends rising, all we lose all our shoreline libraries and what have you. My archive is a shoreline library. I wonder what, maybe it's not going to be here because Connecticut will be underwater.
Beyond Protein, very often, the show we've been watching that's on HBO right now about trying to establish a colony, there's a lot of anxiety about breeding and propagation that feels very much like just sort of heterosexual narrative conventions and Freudian psychology. And I wonder how we can survive and still have our sexualities that we want to have.
I don't know. I mean, you gotta remember that we've been here for a number of millions of years. 3.5 million years. We've more or less looked like we looked. We've only had anything resembling civilization for maybe 6 or 7,000 years, and we've only had writing for 2,000 years, and most of our problems come from what we have done with writing and technology and the various things that it has allowed us to do. Clearly, the technology has progressed far faster than our evolution, physical evolution. So what are you going to do,
One question, maybe a little bit further afield, but I guess thinking about what you were talking about in terms of shifts in, human history and a kind of compressed current moment, one thing I guess thinking as somebody who has turned to sci-fi, science fiction, SF, as a way to start to imagine a kind of future and even imagine my own place within that future. One thing that we notice a lot in the sort of, sci-fi film and a lot of the sort of dominant science fiction is a kind of whiteness of the future. And one of the things that I think makes so many of us appreciate your work is that it's not a simple sort of, replacement, right? Like the astronaut is now, this person, therefore everything's okay. Your approach to race is really complicated in the way that you pictured in the future. Yeah. How do you think about this when you're devising the characters who live in this post-Earth future?
Well, the notion of race has not existed for that long. The term race comes from Raza, which means, large family. Literally, it goes back to, it's a Spanish or an Italian word that basically meant very large family. And people wanted a unit that was larger than the immediate family or the immediate family around you, whether extended or just immediate, and smaller than the nation, and so that became this notion of race, that there was another way to group things, and you cannot be more than the ninth cousin of anybody you see on the street. That's just mathematically impossible. You go and you, the person, and you're probably not more than the, what is it? I probably got this all wrong, but you can't be more than the 13th or 14th cousin of the oak trees you see around you. I mean, all of our life is related genetically. Not only do monkeys have, do we and chimpanzees share 95% of our chromosomes, but then we share 80% of them we share with oak trees and dandelions, so you got to, so even the animal vegetable split is actually much smaller than we tend to think about it. And don't get me started on fruit flies.
We'll definitely do fruit flies during the Q&A. And for now, let's thank Samuel Delaney for incredible comments.
Okay, as I said, I really did enjoy the music. The music itself, I thought this is going to be fun to listen to. But you've got to get, if you're going to use the words, mm-hmm. You know, you've got to use them for something. You know, and the voice is a lovely instrument. When I was much younger than you, I composed a piece that was for flute and four voices, literally four singing voices and a flute, and the voices just sang ah, ah, ah. And I put that together when I was about 14 or 15, and I aspired to be a musician as well for a while.
Right.
So we'll have to stage that also and put that on the list. And thank you again. We came here ready for a crit, so we're not shook.
Yeah, I'm not shook. I mean, I teach art, so I know how it is. I actually do. I mean, I'm not going to get defensive. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's introduce our third guest, Anjali Fatima Raza Kolb, who is a scholar of colonial and post-colonial literature and theory, with particular research interests in the history of science and intellectual history, poetry and poetics, gender and sexuality studies, political theory and independence movements, the Gothic and horror, and comparative literary studies. Her forthcoming book, Epidemic Empire, Colonialism, Contagion, and Terror, 1817-2020, is forthcoming on University of Chicago Press, and it lays out the literary and discursive history behind the ubiquitous figure of the terrorism epidemic. She is currently Associate Professor of English at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. Thank you for joining us, Anjali. So in our narrative, after these humans are, you know, excited by the prospect of getting their society together, it all sort of gets thwarted when a microbe invades them, colonizes the colonizers, and then some changes happen. And so that was really, not only is your book obviously incredibly timely, Epidemic Empire, for thinking about where we are politically and biomedically, but it was also interesting for us to think about colonization and contagion together in this project. I wonder if you would just give us a little intro by expanding on one of the claims that you argue in your book, and I'll quote you briefly. It says, the first of your claims is that the imperial disease poetics that casts insurgent violence as epidemic is grounded in narrative and scientific practices central to the management of empire and neo-imperial formations.
Sure. This takes us all the way back to something that that Pamela raised a few minutes ago regarding our sort of affection for analogy. So the book really is ask this question, like, why in the wake of September 11th did we so easily reach for this figure of the terrorism epidemic? And I framed it as I started researching it as this kind of dangerous metaphor, which is a deep dive into a shallow figure. So get ready to break your neck. And it turns out that the insistence that anti-colonial insurgency or rebellion against colonial occupation is something like a contagion or a disease goes back to the 1817 cholera outbreak in the British Empire. And one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading your libretto and listening to the piece is how like embedded in that very first story of the first global epidemic, which was cholera, a disease that was endemic to the Bengal Delta in India, was the environmental transformation of imperial resource extraction. So something that Pamela raised earlier as well, like if we can't imagine movement in space without monetization, well, we get that. That's our legacy from the Dutch Golden Age, the age of imperial expansion, which says there's no reason to go anywhere unless we can extract profit. So in the context of cholera going from an endemic disease to an epidemic disease, you simply had East India Company troops. So just remember, this wasn't even an empire yet. It was literally a private company. It had its own army that was deforesting the mangrove swamps in the Delta region around Calcutta. And in that deforestation, changing the environment such that this disease spread through waterways, spread through populations, and there was born this global epidemic. In 1832, it went to Europe and then all the way to North America. And then there were other waves throughout the 19th century. So what the hell does this have to do with politics is sort of what I was trying to get at in the book. And you know, it's money, I think, to return to the almighty in that instance pound sterling, but now dollar. And part of what I discovered in researching the book was that this pattern unfortunately holds in dealings, metaphorical, literary, and political dealings with the British colonies in India, with the French colony in Algeria, with the US neo-empire all throughout the Middle East and South Asia. So I won't go on forever, but that's the kind of premise of the book.
Let me just ask one more following up on that. I've been, you know, I guess just sort of musing about the kind of way, certain kind of declarations of whiteness in our present always talk about themselves as sort of embattled and endangered and they're coming for us. And I thought, well, that's really maybe kind of historically situated in the project of settling North America, which was quite dangerous. You know, there was like hundreds of years of violent conflict around occupying land. So I wanted to ask you, like, what do you think about this kind of figure of whiteness as embattled and endangered in these kind of colonial projects? And how does that figure, which is a much bigger philosophical question, but how does that figure also come to stand in for the idea of human?
I love this question. It kind of picks up on the second part of what you were asking earlier, which I didn't really address, which is like, in your own story, how do we feel and like what, and I also was interested in following on Chip's point earlier, like what the music makes us feel about the kind of revenge of the microbe or the revenge of the contagion. Like you're suddenly rooting for that indigenous, right? That indigenous infection. You're like, yeah, stage the counter, stage the insurgency. This is also how it was talked about in the 19th century. The vengeful glass of water, the vengeful ice cube, right? Was actually India fighting back against the empire. These stories are useful and fun. I also think to bring it together with sort of the Gothic and horror, it also gave rise to like a really century-long project, and in some ways two-century-long project of Imperial Gothic or Oriental Gothic, where there's this kind of continuity between the non-human and the monster, or the brown human and the monster, or the microbe. You know, I think it's important also, though, to recall, as you're pointing out, Malik, that like the work of empire was not just dangerous, and kind of life ruining. It was also foisted on poorer white people. Like there's a class aspect to this as well, where if you think about imperial history in kind of the simplest terms, like the British sons who inherited land or who went into the church were not the ones who were sent abroad to make their fortune. The ones who were sent abroad to make their fortune were either needed to enlist in the military, the merchant marines, or these private armies that were serving corporations, or they were disinherited third sons who didn't have any kind of land coming to them. So it's also important to remember that there was this massive sacrifice. And I'm saying this because it's so much the language that we have around COVID-19 now, where like there are some essential workers who have to martyr themselves to the project of continuing to extract profit and resources from in North America right now from our own existing economy, but that's connected to global resource extraction as well. So this idea of the threatened white human, it doesn't come from nowhere. It's a risky enterprise and it's immunologically risky. It was literally navigation risky, as is space travel and space research now. And a lot of the people who were put at risk were those who didn't have choices otherwise. I mean, some of them certainly did. Some imperial adventurers certainly did. This is not a defense of Columbus, but there's an important story here also about risk.
Yeah, that's so true.
I'm trying to think about which way, how to follow up, because this has been actually extremely helpful. Yeah. Did you point at something? Yeah. But there's one question that we have that keeps coming back. So is indigeneity a helpful concept when we think about life on other planets?
I love this question, and I wish I had an answer to it. I think, here's what I've been thinking about since you guys asked me this question. Is there a way of thinking, and I'm changing the question a little bit, so yeah, pull me back in if you want to hear something different, but is there a way of thinking about movement that's non-imperial? You posited earlier refugee, right? Like if we continue to create a planet, not if we are creating a planet that is going to be soon uninhabitable. What does it mean to imagine ourselves as refugees or as, I was also thinking, hearing Pamela talk earlier about our responsibilities to a planet that we have wrecked, like, are we in a situation where we're basically doing palliative care? Like, is this end of life ethics that we need to be involved in somehow? And that really, it led me in some senses away from indigeneity in terms of, like, indigeneity is a concept that says they who are already here, and more toward a kind of cosmology or a practice or an ethos with regard to, and I think this comes back to questions that Chip was raising about the libretto, like, if we can imagine, and to some extent I think we can, and I loved this part, Alex, of your libretto, the obsidian hills, right, the ashen lichen, these are colors that haven't yet come to life because we don't exactly know how to perceive the landscape that you're describing. But if we can think, I'm thinking with writers like Robin Kimmerer, who's braiding sweetgrass, has been super, super useful to me as a poet and as a scholar of science. Like, I don't know that indigeneity in thinking about or imagining space travel, I don't know how useful that is. I think learning from the environment is a very useful context. And in your, I believe it's the second part of the libretto, you give such a gorgeous and like devastating and damning picture of like what Americans do when they get somewhere. It's like, get the architects, let's do the blueprint, build the greenhouses. Like they don't even look around, right? They're just like, they're there and they're building. And it's heartbreaking. So I think that cosmologies that include ethical systems that include a relationship with the earth as already like not a space but a being, right? I mean, you guys asked this question earlier about like the kind of philosophical whitewashing of subjectivity as all persons are white persons, right? But why are we even just talking about persons? I think all of us have, Chip and Pamela have also raised this in different ways. Your piece raises this in different ways. So yeah, to me, useful in that way as a starting point. And I know that there's a lot more about it that I don't know.
Right. No, that's so helpful. Yeah. I mean, one thing I guess as a literary scholar, I'd like to ask if you could, you know, following on that, comment on the potential for speculative fiction to open up ways out of narrative conventions, even as literary genres with their own specific conventions kind of reinforce narrower ways of reading. I guess I'm wondering about this because you know so much about the genre fiction and we're trying to use genre in some ways against itself.
And also the musical score kind of shifts styles radically depending on who the sort of subject of the chapter is. So we're thinking a lot about musical genre too.
Yeah, I love this question so much and I'm gonna try not to talk about it forever. First of all, I think that the section that you played for everybody who was part of this conversation tonight was the section that I immediately played for my girlfriend. I was like, you have to come and listen to this. This is amazing. And it's the snare and it's the horn. Like these are military instruments. They have a kind of history of performative occupation, performative centrality of the state, arming of the state. I think that's a genre. I would say that the imperial expansion or exploration narrative is a genre that's part of what you're doing as well. It's obviously speculative, it's obviously science fiction, but it's also very obviously sort of military memoir. It's also very obviously to me, I don't know if you guys are exactly the same age as me, but it's like, it's also Oregon Trail, like it's pioneers and it's like playing those games and, you know, it's dysentery in Oregon Trail. You're like getting across the country and getting sick. I think that, I think I also felt, and this may help with Chip's suggestions also around landscape. I felt the Bible, I felt Genesis so strongly in the libretto. You mentioned just it, as we were discussing before, like what has led us here, right? In the story of Starquire, how did we get here? And I felt like that question for me was even stronger when I was thinking about the biblical intertext, because I was like, okay, what's the Exodus? Like, where did the scattering come from? How did this start? But then there's a whole chapter 11 of Genesis moment where there's the scattering and a re-diasporic kind of movement. And if we, I don't know. I think for me, the thing is to keep, I mean, there's also nature lyric in what you're doing. I don't know, Alex, if you've read Tommy Pico's nature poem, but it's a piece of writing that's incredibly important to me and to a lot of people that I collaborate with. And I think it's worth reading because I also just hear like a kind of pastoral lyric in what you're doing. And to answer your question, finally, I think all of those genres are here and each one of them hybridizing with the other is exactly how you get out of the narrative conventions that can sometimes constrain you if you're just in the space of like a classic Gothic, right? Where there's certain kind of rules and those rules have to be obeyed. I would also say like this came up a little bit earlier, but as a group of majority queer people who are talking to each other, how does genre, who's, you know, it's a word that's based in the same root as gender. So how do we like think about the possibilities, the speculation, the future that isn't a heteroreproductive or heteronormative reproductive future? That's one thing that we do in stories about people and in life, but I think it's also something that can happen through genre mixing and breaking genre rules, and sort of, this phrase is really overused, but I think in this context, it's kind of important, like queering generic conventions.
Queer genres are a great place to dwell as we wrap this up. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation. Any final remarks, Zandro?
Thanks for being there and see you at the observatory.